So in the message that I received, the name of your lecture is called The Opioid Epidemic. And I want to just sort of focus on that word epidemic, because it seems to have a sort of a meaning in the medical parlance. Is that the right word for this?
Epidemic is exactly the right word. In fact, it's the third largest epidemic in American history. The flu pandemic, 1918, the HIV epidemic, extended over, it wasn't just 1 year, but it was about 8 years when it was at epidemic proportions. And the next largest ever recorded in this country is the opiate epidemic, with 64,000 people dying in 2016. It exceeds the casualties, entire war fatalities in Vietnam over that entire span. And it's driven in part by health behaviors, both prescribing behaviors, which helped catalyze the rapid rise in opioid exposures across the population, and driven by adverse health behaviors in our consumers of opioids, including those who've prefer to be in a opioid stupor rather than engage in life and meaningful, purposeful activities.
So much when we think about drug use, we think about people who are ne'er-do-wells. There's a moral sort of failing there. Do you think that has changed with this particular epidemic?
Great question. I think that's very pertinent, because stigmatization of addiction disorder, as you mentioned, is clearly related to ne'er-do-wells, but that's infected having chronic pain. That's a stigmatized condition as well. So we take one stigmatized state, confound it with another. If pain equals opioids and opioids equal addiction, basic arithmetic means that pain equals addiction. And it's just an overwhelming burden on patients with pain to be so labeled. It's interesting that medical students, who I play a big role in teaching medical students in University of Washington Seattle campus and out here now at Gonzaga, about right after our conversation, I'm having a workshop roundtable with them. And they describe after the education we deliver to them that they've learned two important things. One is these pain patients are really nice. The word pain patient is itself stigmatizing, but that word's hard to shake. But that means after 4 years of their education as a medical student, they viewed these people as ne'er-do-wells in some respect, just having a chronic disease. And the other thing they say that they learned is that there's something you can do for them. Indeed, if you don't think you can help someone, it becomes a discouraging task of being a caregiver, either at home as a family member caregiver or as a clinical caregiver, as a physician, nurse, physical therapist, psychologist. They're stigmatized across the board.
So I was interested in your mentioning the medical students, because I wanted to ask you about the effect on the prescription habits, not only of the new doctors that we're training, but also on doctors like you who've been around a little while. Is there sort of a sea change for physicians when it comes to how do we treat pain in this?
Absolutely. I'd say it's like Scylla and Charybdis sea change, steering between two poles, one of which is the undertreatment of pain, which we confronted really in the late 80s and early 90s. And now the overtreatment with opioids, but yet still the undertreatment of pain, because pain is best treated without opioids. In fact, it's best treated without any of the pharmaceuticals that we use for them. It's way more complicated than a pill can solve, because it involves the social environment that our patients live in, home, work, economic, community, and it involves their psychological state, which is shaped beginning at early childhood, in terms of potentially living in a high-stress home life abandonment, abuse, neglect, physical violence, sexual abuse, awful, all these awful things, and that changes the way the brain behaves. And it's therefore famously known as a bio, in other words, a biomedical condition. It affects the brain and the spinal cord and the other organs that are parts of our ordinary bodies. And then it affects the social and psychological components. So it's a biopsychosocial disorder. The first pain clinic in the world started at University of Washington. The first chair of anesthesia at the University of Washington was the founder of pain as a clinical specialty and as a science. I'm old enough to have been around when John Bonica, a.k.a. Johnny Bull Walker, because he was a wrestler and it was conduct unbecoming an officer because he was in the U.S. Army, and so he wore a mask, and he became known as the Masked Marvel. John Bonica himself had a lot of pain as a result of his wrestling and boxing career. The model of care that was being disseminated at that point was non-pharmacological. It was rehabilitation of soul, of spirit, of job, of family, of behavior, and the thinking that we have in response to having sensory symptoms that become overwhelming. And the most effective treatment then and the most effective treatment today is non-pharmacological, which means patients have to do things other than open a pill bottle and take some pills. And when patients are reassured, just take these pills and your pain will go away, and it doesn't work, they take more. And the field of medicine took a wrong turn, imagining good intentions, but these horrible outcomes that you just keep pushing these opioids, you'll be able to take away pain. And instead, we sensitize the brain, we anesthetize the patients, and we pull them out of functional society. And now we own the problem. We should own the problem morally and ethically as healers. This is something that medicine needs to change. So the students are shocked when they see people even on any opioids on a continuing basis. So their practices are clearly going to change. But us old-timers and even middle-career folks lived through an era when it was encouraged. In fact, people were disciplined if they didn't take care of pain, using as many opioids as it required. So there is a giant paradigm shift, and unfortunately the people getting hit by this swinging pendulum are our patients and providers who are saying, I don't want any part of this business. I'm just not going to take care of pain. Too tricky, too much of a problem. And it's produced, actually, I think, an ethical conundrum. We had someone at a meeting last night from the area who made some calls to a bunch of clinics, and she reported, this is non-scientific, that 40% of the clinics, when she said, oh, I need to find a new doctor, what's your problem? I have a chronic pain problem. And 40% of the clinics said, we don't take care of chronic pain. And she said, where can I go? And she said, well, you just have to call another clinic. And that's an abomination to the spirit of medicine. Medical students write, the number one line in medical student applications is to relieve pain and suffering. And we can't abdicate that.
So do doctors feel under siege? Because after all, they've been doing what they were trained to do. They thought they had these great, tools, and we find out that the tools aren't as great as we thought they were. And is that, you talked about the moral and ethical dilemmas, and is that leading to a moral and ethical dilemma within your, the profession of we don't know what to do anymore?
I like the word. I may quote you. It is a siege. It's a siege for a bunch of reasons, and this is the system problem. So one of the system problems early on was the fact that you couldn't find anyone who could deliver the social and psychological therapies and the physical rehabilitation, because insurance companies weren't willing to pay for it. They wanted quick outcomes. Back in my earlier career days, a month's worth of OxyContin, the cost, would cover an entire clinical treatment protocol for cognitive behavioral therapy, which has proven evidence of benefit, and it's durable. So instead, drug companies said, oh, we'll just pay for the OxyContins. Meanwhile, Purdue was promoting OxyContin, $200 million a year in marketing. And they generated in this interval $35 billion between 1996 and 2007. And in 2007, they had a settlement for false marketing, and it cost them $630+ million in fines. So that's a 55 times return on investment. What a great deal. And now they're being sued by every state in the country. Spokane County just jumped in the suit as of yesterday, I learned. And it's going to be similar to the tobacco settlement.
Yeah, and so I was going to ask, is it right that that pharmaceutical companies like that are carrying the burden for that? Because after a while, you know, you get enough suits against you, you're going to drive them into bankruptcy. And also that question of, do doctors continue to have those relationships with the pharmaceutical companies and take money from the pharmaceutical companies? Are you going to get doctors rethinking that?
Well, that's being done, the rethinking of any kind of connections. The Sunshine Law actually is a you know, congressional requirement that anything of value you take, it's reported both by you, and if you don't report it, these companies have to report it. So that's significantly changed multiple behaviors. So there's been a change there. Many Medical Society, national annual meetings, et cetera, are beginning to shun the manufacturers. And that's a challenge because it's hard to put on a meeting without getting outside funding. And we do want our professionals to get together and learn. And there's no other resources, sort of philanthropy, to be able to support this. Is it fair for the pharmaceuticals manufacturers to take the full hit? I don't know. There's always many more factors contributing than any single entity in such a complex issue. The medical profession, I think, is paying the price in terms of the despair that they're seeing in their patients. People go into this field because they want to have their customers or patients feel better, and they want to be able to do something. So they feel much of the grief that they're encountering as well. The practices are changing in response to that. And the systems of care have to change, because if you can't find a pain-trained psychologist, because psychologists stigmatize these patients too, there's nothing I can do, and they're awful patients. A pain-trained physical therapist, not a sports medicine physical therapist, but someone who understands chronic pain. Pain after a sports medicine injury hurts because you have damage to the area, and the young, healthy, athletic types recover. Pain with chronic pain has nothing to do with continuing injury or damage in that area often, and it's a whole different approach. So you need specially trained people in that domain. They also stigmatize it as a general profession. So without those professionals out there, there was nothing else for physicians to do. They also weren't trained. I received exactly 0 hours of pain education when I was a medical student. That was back in the 70s. In the early 2000s, it was average across this country 7 hours. That sounds like a lot, but that's over 4 years. And when you look at those curriculum, it was mostly about addiction and opioids. It wasn't about treating pain correctly. So big changes are occurring in that. UW and our Gonzaga students are now getting up to 26 hours. National leaders, because we have to train the incoming workforce. The other problem is the poor primary care doc in the clinic got about 15 minutes. Half the visit you spend doing the required preventative medicine stuff. The other half the visit, you navigate the 7 other chronic conditions the patient's talking about. The other half the visit, you see, it's going to come up to longer than a visit. And in fact, they have no time at all on the treadmill of production that's expected. So they are untrained, overwhelmed with a workload that they cannot manage, no resources to send the patients to, no organized policies. They were confused by experts who kept telling them, yeah, just give more opioids. Now they're trying to dig out. So the first thing they're doing is they're stopping digging. Some are bailing out. But the clinicians who we strive to have, and I certainly hope we're creating in the workforce, and the senior mid and late career physicians that I meet across the state, just met last night, a whole group, they're folks who really want to do the right thing. They're carrying a load and working with what we call these legacy folks, people that have been on high doses. They're not addicts. They've just been doing what they've been told. And now the carpet's being pulled out from under them. This is the sea change, the siege, as you described, that they feel. And some are just refusing to take care of these patients. And that can't be done. So we need to give them the tools to do it. We need to give them the training to accomplish it. And we need to give them the resources to the patients so they can afford the more complicated, ultimately far less expensive, but services that are frequently not covered by any insurer.
So I just want to follow one more area because I've taken enough of your time. Most of the stories we hear about these, the worst of the epidemic are in places like Huntington, West Virginia, and small towns in Ohio, and Terre Haute, Indiana, and a lot of these Rust Belt places. Are there places in rural Washington, rural Idaho, rural Oregon that sort of, you know, rise to that level? And if not, why not? What would be going, I guess, right in this case?
Well, if you look at a heat map that the Centers for Disease Control and other federal agencies do when they show the whole country, indeed, the rural and socioeconomically disabled communities take the lion's share of the hit. You know, opiate addiction and problems with heroin used to be an urban problem, but they're, because of the prescription deluge, there's not a behavioral therapist in every rural town in America, nor is there a physical therapist, but there sure is a pharmacist in every town in America. So it got launched into these potential communities, and they don't really have those potentially available resources. So actually, Spokane and Whitman County and Stevens County out here, they're about the same as King County in terms of the overdose death rates that are occurring. Lincoln and Columbia are similar to the West Virginia and the Ohio rural areas. And the Ferry, Penderay, Aslan, they're about in the middle. And interestingly, Adams and Franklin, just going over a map recently, are the state prize winners at having low opiate overdose rates.
Low opiate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, low. There's some winners here, just like there is in the western part of the state. And it distributes to generally the least resourced, the most socioeconomically distressed populations. But if you don't have a job, you don't have a future, you don't have an education, and you're struggling with meaning and purpose in your life, and you can take away the social pain and the emotional distress, and the body responds to social and emotional distress by activating the pain system, hardwired, chemically and structurally. When you are socially isolated or feel socially isolated or under psychological stress or have post-traumatic stress disorder from whatever cause, environmental or military cause, the pain system is activated, and it tends to be activated in a resistant way that often belies ordinary treatments. An opioid temporarily takes the sting away. However, after a few months of using opioids, you reduce the opioids, the pain comes back in force. And in fact, resuming the opioids, you can't even get back to pain relief. And for an addict, the euphoria you get quickly turns out to just feeling normal, and pretty soon even taking the opioid, even at the previous dose, you can't even get to feeling normal. So hijacking your endorphin systems is a bad thing to do, and it leads to personal ruin, financial ruin, disability, economic costs that are uncountable. In fact, the opiate abuse epidemic I recently saw published has cost the United States $80 billion annually, the social and medical costs that are associated with that. So it's a giant problem. It's going to take all hands on deck. I'm committed to training our workforce from beginning to late career, and we are working with policymakers. We're working with legislators to insist that the right things are being done to their constituencies. And we got to educate our patients to be better consumers, meaning understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, what the expectations are. And good heavens, don't take opioids for longer than 3 months, because there's a 65% chance you're going to be an opioid for the rest of your life. And time, dose, duration, expectations, attitudes, all this is something that's going to come from our customers.
Well, I hope for your sake that you don't internalize a lot of this, so you don't despair from all of this, because you have to deal with it every day.
Actually, I was a primary care doctor. I still feel like I am. I think I'm one of those people on the front line. And the most satisfying aspect of my practice, even at the peak of this epidemic, turned out to be taking care of people with chronic pain, because there's so much that can be done. There's so much relief that occurs once the right things are done. I could manage a high blood pressure patient like the best of them, you just say, well, thanks, doc, you got my blood pressure under control, but you don't have the family coming in and just saying, thank you so much for giving us my husband, wife, father, son, daughter, cousin, nephew, grandma, grandpa, whatever it is. You gave them back to us. And it's not just getting off drugs, but it's getting off the pain cycle, which is a sensation so awful that you can't close your eyes, hold your nose, shut your ears to block. But with training, mindfulness-based stress reduction, the most effective treatment. Yoga therapies, Tai Chi, diet hygiene, regular daily exercise, all the kind of simple stuff to say. They sound sort of ma, pa, and apple pie. Turn out to be the most effective for nearly all people with chronic pain. And I'm happy to say at this point, there's never been a reported overdose of mindfulness. And anyone of your audience, please call me day or night. I want to be the first to write the report if that occurs. Okay. And it is the most effective treatment for chronic pain, currently demonstrated, publication last year out of the University of Washington and Kaiser Permanente collaboration. So right here in Washington State, we figured out early on how you take care of chronic pain. And when we do something here in Washington State about pain and opioids, like the old E.F. Hutton ad, when Washington State talks, everyone's listening. Because we wrote the first guidelines, had the first educational programs in the state, the first to be sued by the pharmacy-funded advocacy groups for denying pain care. And our guidelines are enshrined in the Centers for Disease Control guidelines. And we're still pushing on. So I think instead of being discouraged, I'm enthusiastic about the fact that the solutions are there. This is not a mystery. It's just a matter of organizing the systems at every level to do the right thing. And we're trying as educators in an academic setting to demonstrate to them and instruct them as requested, and to fit it into their environment, rural, which is different than urban, suburban, different than both, across the state.